Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2011-2005, State of Ohio versus Jason Dean. For the appellant, Ms. McGarry.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. I would like to focus the argument this morning on the third issue and the first issue, which are very interrelated. Jason Dean is before this court in a case in which 7 different persons were named as victims, yet even the state concedes that Jason Dean only shot one of the 7 persons, and that gunshot was to the shoulder of Andre Pearsall and did not kill him. This has not been an easy case. It was not an easy case for the jury. The jury deliberated over 3 days during the course of the trial phase and over 2 days during the course of the penalty phase. One can't help but wonder if the reason that the jury had such a difficult time with this case was because Jason Dean was not the person who fired the shot killing Titus Arnold. The specification that brings this case to the court is the course of conduct specification. The course of conduct specification as laid out on the verdict forms included the names of 6 different persons, and the jury was required to circle the names of the persons that they believed were in the course of conduct. 4 of the 6 persons included in the course of conduct were the persons that were on the porch at the Dibert Avenue address when shots rang out trying to hit the house. So I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about the Dibert Avenue offenses. There are so many inconsistencies in the testimony of the witnesses as that relates to that offense. The people that were actually on the porch, and Devon Williams, who was across the street, all testified that there was only one person in the vehicle. And Devon Williams, who actually saw the person in the vehicle, identified that person as Josh Wade, the co-defendant in this case. Crystal Caboose, who was the defendant's former girlfriend, is the only one who puts him in the car. And she puts herself in the car as well. So she says that Mr. Dean was in the passenger seat of the car, and she was riding in the back seat of the car. But the state's theory, even if we go with the state's theory in this case, was that Jason Dean was sitting in the passenger seat. And as the car made the first pass up the street, he shot into the car of Devon Williams. When the car turned around and came back, it was Josh Wade who actually is the one who shot at the porch. Where the people were standing. So even under the state's theory, Jason Dean is not the person who shot at the porch. So the question becomes, how do we get 4 counts of attempted murder in this case? In the second proposition, we argue that there was insufficient evidence and the verdicts were against the weight of the evidence. But to understand how we get to these attempted murder convictions, you need to look at the third proposition of law, which deals with transferred intent. The idea of transferred intent was introduced in the case by the prosecutor during closing argument. However, when the prosecutor discussed transferred intent, he was actually talking about it as it related to the shooting of Titus Arnold, because his theory was that Jason Dean and Joshua Wade were actually trying to shoot a person named OZ, and they mistook Mr. Arnold for this person, and that you could use that transferred intent to find a conviction in this case. But the jury latched onto the idea of transferred intent. And on the second day of deliberations, they sent out a note saying, in an attempted murder, does it matter if the person identified in the charge is the intended target or not? The court and the counsel had much discussion about whether or not a transferred intent instruction should be given. And in the end, the court decided to give a transferred intent instruction. This was error. This was an erroneous instruction to try to use transferred intent for an attempted murder instruction. You have to look and say, what intent is transferred when no one is shot? Devon Williams, who supposedly was the person that they were trying to shoot his car up, was not injured, and no one on the porch was injured. So what intent is being transferred? This court has never addressed this issue of whether or not you could use transferred intent for an attempted murder.
Do consequences of an action relate to transferred intent, in your view, counsel? Here we have a drive-by shooting. We have people in the house, and the shots are fired into the house, and the consequences of that shooting certainly can lead to a homicide. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I would.
And you're saying consequences don't mean anything in transferred intent?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying in a case where, well, first of all, we have to look at, you know, what intent was there. And even assuming that, you know, we agree with the state's version of the facts, the only intent that anybody talked about was to, one, shoot the car, and not even really shoot the car. The conversation that supposedly happened between Jason Dean and his brother Mark was that we're going to go out to Dibert Avenue, find the car, and find the house. There was no discussions that we're going to shoot up the car, we're going to shoot up the house, we're going to try to kill Devon Williams. None of that was ever mentioned.
But that's what happened.
That is what happened. But shooting the car doesn't make Mr. Dean responsible for the attempted murder of the persons who were on the porch. They were charged with shooting a firearm or a weapon into an occupied structure, so that covers, you know, the actual shooting at the house. But if you're going to get an attempted murder charge, you need to have the specific intent to purposely kill each of those four people. And there was
no. Don't you infer the intent from the use of a deadly weapon? We give that instruction all the time. Purpose and intent mean the same thing. When you discharge a deadly weapon, the intent is to cause the death, is it not?
His specific intention would have to be to cause the death. Just shooting the gun itself doesn't mean that you have an intent. You have to have the intent to kill the person.
But you can infer the intent from the use of the
it's
deadly weapon.
It's not a conclusive presumption, and when the remaining evidence...
What is the presumption that would be otherwise?
That is just
a presumption.
I'm sorry?
That is the presumption.
But it's not conclusive, and in this case, I'm sorry?
Is it rebutted?
Right, yes, it is rebutted, because there's no evidence that they had any intent to shoot anyone.
But
the fact that they shot differently.
It seems as though your whole argument is a quarrel with the findings of the jury.
Well,
we're not going to go back and refine facts. We're going to write some rule of law that will apply in these kinds of circumstances. And we have jury instructions, which presumably the court complied and followed.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because the jury, I believe that the jury instruction is where the problem lies, is that indeed that the prosecutor tried to argue that somehow there was this intent to shoot Devon Williams that transferred to the persons on the porch. And Devon Williams was not injured in any way, nor was anybody on the porch.
The target, correct?
That is the state's theory. I mean, he was standing right there by his car. If Mr. Wade had wanted to shoot Devon Williams, all he had to do was take the gun, put it out his window, and shoot him, because he was standing right by the car. But he didn't. He instead chose to shoot up the house.
He came down to look at his car when it was being shot, right?
Correct.
I mean, he came off the porch, if I recall?
Correct.
Okay. And so you're saying that... Right, then let me back up. What was the purpose then of your client shooting up the porch?
My client didn't shoot the porch.
Well, he said there was testimony, I think, was it Jason Manns that Dean said he shot at people coming out of the house, and one of them was holding the baby in his arms, and he almost shot. Was that not the testimony?
There was evidence to that effect that came in from the testimony of a man's who, again, the credibility is questionable, but it's not.
Well, obviously
his,
the jury believed him, so.
But his testimony is not consistent with the evidence in the case. So, I mean, you know, what somebody says after the fact to somebody else regarding the offense is that tale is inconsistent with the facts of the case, because the only bullets that were found in the porch after the offense were 40 caliber, and that was the weapon that Joshua Wade had. It was not weapon that Jason Dean had. The weapon Jason Dean had was a 25 caliber, and that was the guns that were found in the car. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so if he shot up the car, and even the state concedes that.
But that's the weapon that was found to have shot up the car.
Correct. But okay. Again, shooting a car is not attempted murder.
So just help me understand, they shot up the car first, drove down the street, turned around, came back, and then shot up the porch.
And then Josh Wade shot at the porch, yes. And so, you know, the error that, I mean, there's two issues related to the attempted murders. A separate issue, first of all, was there sufficient evidence of an attempted murder? But the problem in this case comes from the third proposition of law. And did the jury get there by listening to an erroneous instruction? In other words, can we, in Ohio, use transferred intent to convict someone of an attempted murder?
Counsel, if I want to ask you on that, I believe you answered Justice O'Donnell that in regard to the transferred intent, it is a rebuttable presumption and it was rebutted. And that's been rolling around inside my head for 2 minutes. We'll get to that in a minute. But I think you just said also that shooting at an occupied car with a weapon is not attempted murder. How?
No, I was talking about shooting at the house.
You said shooting at a car is not attempted murder in responding to the chief.
I apologize that I might have misspoke,
okay.
But yeah.
Because you got me confused, and that's not hard to
no,
do.
No,
okay.
No, I'm focusing right on the Dibert Avenue offense where they actually shot at the house.
Counsel, was this transferred intent doctrine raised at trial?
There were discussions off the record during the course, but the prosecutor did not ask for an instruction on transferred intent when it came time to charge the jury. It never came up until the second day of deliberations. It came up during his closing argument, he mentions it, but as far as it related to any kind of charge to the jury or anything the jury heard officially on it, that did not happen until the second day of deliberations.
And did the defense object?
Yes, he did.
To the transferred intent instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. He said that at first he started out saying he believed it was a correct statement of the law on transferred intent, but he did object to giving the instruction. And he objected for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons was he thought that, when they had some discussions off the record in the court's chambers concerning the transferred intent, the prosecutor believed that the transferred intent related to the Dibert Avenue offenses. And so he had a problem then when he started thinking about it more about using this transferred intent to find somebody guilty of attempted murder, and that's when he objected.
Was the jury instruction that was given strictly discussing the drive-by shooting, or was it to accommodate the Arnold killing?
Well, it wasn't to accommodate the Arnold killing because, again, the question asked specifically about attempted murder, and I think that, the charge the court gave was that all offenses of murder, including attempted murder and aggravated murder, have one of the essential elements that the defendant had the purpose to cause the death of another. And so he goes on to say that you can use it for all the offenses. So they were led to believe they could use it for the attempted murder offense. And, you know, the fact that they had been thinking about it for a day and then they get to the point where, you know, they have to put their names on the verdict forms, that's when, you know, they start saying, well, you know, can we use this transferred intent doctrine? Particularly since I think, you know, Jason Dean's not the one who shot up the porch. So, I mean, again, they're in that situation of, like, how do we find this person guilty when, indeed, he's not the one who shot the gun? The reason that these offenses are so important is because they do make up the vast majority of names that are included in on the course of conduct specification. So that affects when we get to the weighing process the jury is then going to have to do in the penalty phase, in which this court will have to do when it makes its appropriateness determination. If you take out those four people, you're left with a much less weighty course of conduct specification. And the prosecutor in their closing argument emphasized over and over again what great weight that they need to give this factor, because we just really can't have people going out shooting up other people all the time. And so it should be a factor that the court or the jury gives great weight to.
Counsel, are you arguing that because Wade shot at the porch and it wasn't Dean, that because he wasn't the principal offender? Is that what you're saying here?
Well, that is also a factor. That's not specifically.
I mean, you don't have to be a principal offender to engage in a course of conduct, correct?
Correct.
All right. I just wanted to clarify that.
Correct, yes. So now we get to the problem of having to weigh this aggravating circumstance, which is, you know, if you take into account the argument I'm making, it's a much less weighty aggravating circumstance. And so we have to now, you know, the court will now have to do the appropriateness and proportionality determination. Interesting, I looked, and the court has heard almost 300 capital cases and issued opinions in that many cases. And the recurring theme, as I'm sure you will admit, is that when you look at somebody who is before you charged with a capital offense, oftentimes the recurring theme is, what is their history, character, and background? What has happened to them in their lives that have brought this case before the court? And I think we can't help but come to the conclusion that the environment that somebody grows up in is often the reason why a person ends up in front of this court. There's a connection between how we treat our children and what actions they take as they grow up. So we reach the question of, how did Jason end up here? Jason grew up in a house where his mother used drugs and his father used alcohol. And interestingly enough, their values were such that the mom thought that it was okay to use drugs but not alcohol, and dad thought it was okay to use alcohol but not drugs, so they were allowed to do both. And so they were started to get drugs and alcohol from their parents at a very early age. I think the earliest I saw was at age 13, and that was the start of their environment in their teen years. Their parents did not have any respect for money and how to spend it. They spent it freely, but not on the children. They used the drugs and the alcohol. They gambled. I thought it was interesting when the aunt was talking about how her sister-in-law had come into this pot of money, and they never really say how much money it was, but they indicate that it was an amount of money that could have been certainly used to help repair their home or do something to advance the family, that mom did not use it for that. The house ended up getting condemned and the money was just frittered away. Mom ended up talking to the kids. She didn't tell them not to go out and steal. They were pretty much taught to go out and steal so that they could bring some of their stolen goods home, sell the goods, and buy more drugs. Instead, she worried about them getting caught, and so what she would do was she would listen to a police scanner when they were out and about, and if the description of the persons on the police scanner fit her son's, she would make sure that the doors were open and wide open so the kids could make an easy entry in and so that they could escape from getting caught from any crimes. School was not valued at all. His cousin talked about how when she stayed with the family that they would, Jason would walk her to school and make sure she went, but he didn't go, nor was he required to go by his parents. And the father often beat not only Jason, but also the mom. So in addition to all this background information that led Jason to be before the court, we also have the factor that he was not the principal offender. And it's not often that factor comes before the court as a mitigating factor. So when this court is reviewing cases and doing a proportionality analysis, it can certainly consider the fact that he wasn't the principal offender.
Counsel, does it weigh in the calculation here that he was a 30-year-old and his accomplice was a 16-year-old who did pretty much what your client told him to do?
Your Honor, I would agree with the first half of your statement. I think, yes, indeed, you know, that's something that needs to be weighed. I mean, he was 30 years old and the co-defendant was 16. But Josh Wade was not somebody who was a shrinking violet, nor did he do anything he wasn't, you know, he didn't want to do. I mean, he was the one who instigated a lot of the stuff. There's no information that, for example, You know, if you even look at the offense itself regarding Titus Arnold, you know, he ran back on his own to the car to get the gun that eventually shot Titus Arnold. So, I mean, he...
Well, because didn't Wade's gun jam?
There was evidence that Jason Dean's gun jammed.
Dean's gun jammed, and so Wade gets the gun and finishes the job.
I mean, but he did it. I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, he pulled the trigger, not my client. You know, and I think that's really a factor that has to be taken into account. And I think one of the other things that really is important is this idea of this course of conduct specification, which is the only specification. And, you know, you have all these people that were not shot. Usually when you have a course of conduct specification, you have two or three people who were actually killed over a period of time, or you have, you know, a lot of people who were killed over a period of time. And in here you have one person who was shot in the shoulder. No one else was shot except the victim, Mr. Arnold, who ended up dying in this case. So you have him not being the principal offender, only one other person is injured and no one else is killed, and he's got, and this is, you know, the information that we're going to use
but
to execute someone.
But this was what he set out to do. Rob people, shoot people. You know, Mr. Arnold, I think, had $6 on him when he killed him, and it turned out to be the wrong person, correct?
Correct. Well, you know, according to Crystal Caboose and the state's theory, it turned out to be the wrong person. If indeed the theory was they were going out to
if they were random,
people,
then he was the intended victim. But then you have, was it Miss Lyles and I forget who the other...
Andre Pearsall at the Mini-Mart.
Right, who happened to be at a convenience store, and they get shot at and hurt as a result of this. This is what these two did. They went out, they randomly selected people to rob, and if it meant using a weapon and shooting them, that was okay.
I disagree, Your Honor. Because the evidence, and even, you know, if we believe Crystal Caboose, I mean, the evidence was that they went out, lured people out of bars, and robbed them. There was no evidence that they had a history of luring people out of bars, robbing them, and killing them. You know, so in even, you know, in the Mini-Mart situation, I mean, we, in the second proposition, we had a problem with the attempted robbery because, you know, according to Yolanda Lyles, who was sitting in the driver's seat, you know, Mr. Dean supposedly ran up to the car and said, "Give me your money," and shot her. I mean, if somebody's going to rob you, they're going to want the money first and then shoot you if that's what they decide they want to do. But in this case, you know, Andre Pearsall said, "I never heard him say ask for money. He just came up to the car and was shooting at me." He said he was shooting at me. And the evidence is consistent that the angle was going over to where Andre Pearsall
was. And was there any reason why he would have been shooting? Was there history there that would have suggested that there was some kind of reason for an altercation such as that?
There was some sort of a history, I believe. Even when Andre Pearsall testified, he had... you know, he was not a choir boy either. I mean, he was actually in prison when he came and testified in Jason's case. So I think there was some sort of a...
Well, they knew each other. I mean, Pearsall said he was inside and he recognized this guy who was out at the car, you know, with the weapon.
Correct. Yeah, he had tried to sell some pills to him, I think, beforehand.
A Valium, and they said, "No, we don't do that." Okay. Bang. You're shot.
No, they went. I mean, he walked away, and for whatever reason, he came back. You know,
and shot him.
And shot at him. Yes.
What offenses would you agree the jury properly convicted the defendant of?
I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, Your Honor.
Well,
they convicted him of all of the offenses.
Yeah. So which ones?
I mean, they were, you know, were pretty sure. I think that he was there at the Titus Arnold murder. I mean, I believe that they believed that, even though there was inconsistent testimony concerning whether he was even there. And I believe, you know, that they probably, you know, he was specifically identified as being involved at the Mini-Mart. I think that the Dibert Avenue really gave them a hard time. I think they just weren't sure that he was, first of all, in the car. And if he was in the car, that, you know, he's not the one who shot up the porch.
Well, what I'm getting at, you don't want,
you're here today arguing that your client, that the death penalty should be overturned, one. But there were a series of things that the jury found, right?
Correct. With respect, there were, I believe, 14 charges in the indictment.
And they convicted him on everything?
Correct.
So what's the outcome if we agree that death is not appropriate? What's the outcome that is appropriate out of what the jury found?
Well,
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, if Your Honor, if you find in this case that the death is not appropriate and that's the only finding you make in Mr. Dean's favor, then he's serving a lot of time. He will never get out of prison because of all of the other offenses.
But you argued that transferred intent should not apply, that he shot up a car, the only person, individual, for which he committed an act that resulted in harm to an individual was the shot at the convenience store. The individual was injured in the arm. So what does that leave? What are you arguing that's left?
That attempt at murder would be left. The shooting into the dwelling at 604 Dibert, which I believe came from his gun because it was on the opposite side of where the car was. The car was parked in front of 604 Dibert. So, I mean, that's a lot of years in and of itself.
Okay, well, so what does all that add up to? I guess that's what I'm asking you, is if your best case that you're arguing to us, if we were to agree with you on every point,
my guess is he still is not getting out.
The outcome for your client, what's left? When you stack it all up, what's left?
I don't have. Yeah, I don't have the number of years, but my guess would be based on the fact that the court ran all of them consecutive that he would never get out. I mean, he's now 40 years old, so.
So in the end, we're really arguing about death or not.
Correct.
You're not arguing for a new trial.
Well, Your Honor, if you were to rule in our favor concerning the transferred intent instruction, I think at that point you would have to send the attempted murders back for a new trial, at least on those charges, and that would probably also affect the capital specification at that point. I'm not sure how that would all play out as far as whether or not they'd have to be a new penalty phase based on if there is a finding again, on the attempted murders without the transferred intent, so that those folks would be or included back in on the course of conduct specification.
I guess what we're trying to find out is what are you advocating on behalf of your client as an outcome if you were successful in your arguments here?
Vacation of the attempted murder charges and the death sentence in this case. Thank you.
Mr. Wilson.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Andy Wilson. I'm the Clark County Prosecutor. I stand before this court today urging you to affirm both the conviction and the sentence of Jason Dean. Just a little bit of history. This is the second time that we've tried this case. I was trial counsel on both cases. In the 2006 trial, I was part of the trial team. That case was reversed on other grounds in 2010. In 2011, I was lead counsel on that case. There are 15 propositions of law before the court. Clearly, I'm not going to be able to address all 15. I'm just going to address a couple.
Counsel, if you may, I'd like to direct your attention to one that I'm troubled by.
Yes, sir.
And please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that the concept of transferred intent was not in the original charge by the court, and based upon comments made by the state in closing arguments, it appears that the jury was confused and therefore asked the court, can you clear this up for us? And the court then gave the charge from OJI of transferred intent. My direct question to you today, so you can clear it up for me, what intent was transferred?
It's not clear from the question from the jury. Let me, can I give you a little bit of background so
please,
you have a better understanding?
Please.
What happened was I was arguing closing argument, and we were setting up a transferred intent argument with respect to the Titus Arnold murder, that they were out looking for OZ, they were looking to rob drug dealers, OZ was a drug dealer, and that prior calculation design and transferred intent transferred over to the murder of Titus Arnold. You can see as you read the transcript, what happened was as I was making that argument, about halfway through that argument, I realized that we hadn't asked for the instruction of law on transferred intent. So I kind of back out a little bit of that argument, and that ends up not being a jury instruction that goes before the court.
To clarify for you, at that time, the jury had not been charged, correct?
That is correct.
You're doing your closing argument.
That is correct.
And charging is coming.
That is correct. And we end up, frankly, we end up forgetting to ask for that instruction with respect to the Titus Arnold. That's absolutely what happened.
You asked for the transferred intent instruction?
We did not. We did not ask for the transferred
intent. But you could have.
We could have. And we wanted to. We blew past it in preparation for everything else that was going on.
So my understanding is correct. It is the jury who is the first ones that asked for the transferred intent instruction.
That is correct. And what happened at that point is the question comes out, and we engage in what happens every time a jury asks a question. You're trying to decipher what exactly it is they want, how do you exactly handle it. And there were several options that were before the judge. He could have ignored it and just not done anything. He could have inquired more about what the jury specifically wanted, but then the fear is you're going to get into the status of their deliberations. He could have sent back an instruction that basically all the law has been provided for you, or he could have sent back the OJI instruction.
But counsel, I guess you're now getting really to my question. We're looking at prejudice here. Are you telling me that you argued to the jury the legal concept of transferred intent? It was in your argument,
with
closing.
With respect to the murder of Titus Arnold.
And yet you did not ask the court to charge the jury on that legal concept.
That is correct.
See the prejudice to the defendant at that point?
I don't, actually. What happened was it never became an issue until this question came out, and this question came out with respect to the attempted murders. When the question came out with respect to the attempted murders, again, one of the problems is we couldn't tell are they talking about Dybert? Are they talking about the mini mart? We can't really figure that out. So the judge, the judge has the discretion when it comes to issuing instructions, and a decision to issue instruction really shouldn't be disturbed absent of abuse of that discretion. And I believe what the judge did in this situation was he looked at the different options and he made a rational decision to look. I think the best option under these circumstances is to issue this general OJI instruction.
Okay, I'm a juror now. What intent got transferred?
Well, there's a couple arguments. Is it the mini mart? Is it the mini mart where Jason Dean comes out and he's shooting at Andre Pearsall and ends up sending a shot towards Yolanda Lyles? Is that the transferred intent we're talking about? Is it the Dybert? Is it the Dybert case where, I mean, clearly it's an attempted murder, so it can only be either the mini mart or the Dybert, the four attempted murders on Dybert. So that gets to the problem with why the judge needs some level of discretion. You just don't know. You just don't know based on that question, and you're trying to figure out, you know, how do we handle this as delicately as possible without getting into the status of the deliberations or anything like that. So the judge exercised his discretion.
Was it clear to the members of the jury that the target of the murder was OZ?
Of the Titus Arnold murder? Yes, sir.
That was clear.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe.
What was the evidence with respect to the target of the attempted murders on Dybert Avenue?
The evidence was what had happened was in the.
Was there some belief that OZ may have been in that home?
What happened was in the days leading up to the Dybert shooting, Jason Dean's brother had been ripped off. He had been ripped off some drugs. OZ is a ne'er-do-well in our town who his thing is ripping off drug dealers. They honestly believe that OZ had ripped him off. The problem is Jason Dean, because he had just gotten out of prison April 1st, doesn't know who OZ is. He doesn't know where he lives, doesn't know where he drives. He just has a general idea of where he's at and what his car looks like. So they're cruising around that neighborhood in Dybert looking to find what they believe is OZ, where OZ lives. So they find that car that they believe is OZ's parked out in front of, it's actually parked across the street from 609 Dybert. It's parked in front of 604. They shoot up that car, send a round into the house, or a couple rounds into the house.
I understand Ms. McGarry's argument. She claims that Dean never fired discharged a weapon into the home. He shot a vehicle, not toward the people at the porch.
Well, he certainly sent a round up into 604.
Pardon me, please?
I said he certainly sent a round up into 604. So what happened there? So across the street, he sends a round in the house. There's a round in the house at 604. They go, after they shoot up the car, they go down the street and they see people running out of the house. They do a U-turn and come back down. As they come back down, shots are fired up into the 609. So the folks are standing up on the porch at 609.
When you say they, who was driving the car?
Josh Wade was driving the car. Jason Dean was in the front passenger seat and Chris Lickles.
Okay, and so when they come by in the first swipe, the car is off to the right, is that correct?
That is correct.
And when they come back on the second, if they turn around, the porch is off to the left.
That is correct.
On the driver's side.
The porch is, no. When they come back, actually, they're shooting at a house across the street. So they're coming back down the opposite way they had just traveled.
Right.
The house is on the right side of the car, on the passenger side. So Josh,
609 is on the passenger side of the car.
When they shoot up 609, it's
okay,
on the passenger side.
The correct side that Jason Dean was sitting
that
on.
That is correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
So what happens is, and we did a really good job, it's probably in the record, well, it would be in the record, but there's a chart that we used where we brought each person out of 609, and we showed exactly where they were on the porch. And there was really almost a separate animus. You could see where a bullet had skipped right at this person, or you could see where if a person was standing over here, you know, the bullet went through the coat of that person. So what we really did is we did a good job of laying out the separate animus towards each person on the porch.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that there was time for the drive-by shooter to take aim at the four people?
At four people up on the porch.
Four people up on the porch. And with some degree of accuracy, land a bullet close to each one of them.
That's what the evidence showed, absolutely. What was interesting...
Isn't the testimony of the four people was that when they saw this car turn around and come towards them and start to shoot, that they all dove on the porch? I mean, they all went down.
They were all on the porch, and they all start taking evasive movements. That's absolutely correct. But what's interesting is... there's not a lot of broken windows down the side of the house. I mean, clearly there was an intent to shoot at these people. It's not like they were just spraying the house. So we were actually able to, yes, the evidence actually showed that bullets were fired in the general direction of each.
Okay,
of
so then talk about who was the actual shooter at the porch.
We know for a fact that Josh Wade was shooting. And
Josh Wade was driving. He was on the opposite side, and he was shooting. How was he shooting? Was he shooting through the passenger window?
That's unclear. That was kind of unclear. There was.
Well, how else would he be doing it?
Well, he could out the front as he's driving, or over the top as he's driving. But I believe he was shooting out across.
Well, that would require Mr. Dean to be pretty far back in the seat. If somebody's using his window as the, exit for the weapon, for
that
the
is
shooting.
Correct. He's also Jason Dean's a real small. He's a very small fella, and Josh Wade's a very tall fella. They were different size, and which again it contributes to why the folks on the porch didn't see him. But yes, he would have been back in the seat, or he would have been if the shots had gone across.
But you're not saying that Dean did the shooting into the porch.
The evidence, again, there was testimony that he did.
Testimony because he said
correct.
To somebody else, not somebody on the porch.
That is correct.
Somebody, Mr. Manns, I believe, and then the girlfriend.
Crystal Caboose.
Yeah. Said that he was doing the shooting.
That is correct.
But there were no,
there was no
bullets that would link it to his weapon.
That is correct. That is correct. Again, he clearly was part of the team. I mean, they were acting in concert for a common criminal purpose of
and
shooting.
You think their intent was to harm or kill OZ?
Yes.
They thought, well, maybe OZ was up there on that porch.
Right. They thought that they had found OZ's car, or OZ's people, and they were coming back by to shoot.
Okay, so the transferred intent was not that they were trying to shoot the four people and Mr. Williams, whose car it was. It was any one of those men could have been OZ.
Any one of those people could have been OZ. That's the whole reason they were out there. That's what brought them out there. Once they see
people. And
that's
the transferred intent that you are.
Well, I mean, that's the motive. That's the precursor for it. There's actually individual intent for each person who's up on that. I mean, clearly, there's only one OZ. So when they see.
So to bring this back to the court, after your argument, the court gave an instruction on transferred intent. Part of which says the purpose required is to cause the death of another person, not any one specific person. If the death was intended for one person but resulted in an attempt on or the death of another, the offense is complete. However, if there was no purpose to cause the death of anyone, the defendant may not be convicted of attempted murder, or aggravated murder. Is that a correct statement of transferred intent? From the court?
That I believe that's straight out of the OJI, yes, Your Honor. So, and that,
so
that
if
actually
the jury
was,
found that the bullets were fired by two persons acting in concert at individuals on the porch in an effort to kill OZ, then according to the instruction, the intent could be transferred to those others on a charge of attempted murder. Is that the court's view of it from the?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Was there objection by the defendant to that instruction?
Not to the form of the instruction. They agreed that that's the straight instruction out of OJI, but there was an objection to the giving of the instruction. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, can we go back just for a second on the evidence related to the drive-by shooting? You said that there was no evidence, specific evidence, to link Dean to the shooting. Did I hear that correctly? Well, I thought there was. We have 25 caliber bullets. We have 40 caliber. At least one of them is in the car that was parked out front.
There's right? a plethora of evidence that links Dean to that shooting. There's okay. No doubt about that. With respect to direct evidence that shows he shot a 25 round into 609 Dibert, there's no direct physical evidence of that. There's Crystal Caboose and Jason Mann's testimony. There's also all the circumstantial evidence that puts him in the car. And again, the instruction of law certainly is that circumstantial and direct evidence both can have the same weight. This court has found that in certain circumstances, circumstantial evidence can be more compelling than direct evidence.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Dean, whose case we're discussing today, shot at the house?
Shot, yes. There's Crystal Caboose's testimony. There's what he told Jason Mann. So, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, he said there. There's the car. There's the two guns. There's all of those things.
No, I understand that, but there was two different caliber of guns. I'm asking you, is there direct evidence that he shot at the person who died?
Oh. You're going back to the Titus Arnold.
Yes, sir.
Murder. No. Jason Dean did not shoot the shot that killed Titus Arnold. And I believe that is the crux of this argument. The issue is whether or not this court is willing to affirm a death penalty where the defendant in the case did not fire the kill shot and the co-defendant who did fire the kill shot cannot get the death penalty. I really think that's where the argument is. I submit to you that the law of both the United States of America and the law of Ohio do allow you to affirm both the conviction and the sentence against Jason Dean.
Well, therefore, getting back to my original question, don't we have to show transferred intent by the 16-year-old shooter? Who were they trying to kill that day?
The day that they killed the day that they killed Titus Arnold, when they jumped out of that car and Jason Dean put that gun, that 25 caliber gun, in Titus Arnold's chest and pulled that trigger and that gun didn't go off, there's no doubt they were trying to kill Titus Arnold. There's absolutely no doubt the intent was there. That gun misfired. And as a result of that misfire, a 16-year-old kid picks up the gun and finishes the job. That's really where we're at.
But there's no, it doesn't matter whether they thought he was OZ or whether they thought he was just Mr. Arnold, or they didn't care who he was.
That's correct. I mean, with respect to the
intent. It didn't matter who he was, let's put it that way.
With the intent to kill, absolutely not. At that point, they had it in their mind they were going to kill him. When Jason Dean, again, pointed that gun and squeezed that trigger, that intent was effectuated. Now, with respect to Jason Dean, a mechanical failure of that gun stopped him from being the principal offender. But Josh Wade, his co-defendant, the juvenile, got out and finished the job.
In earlier responses to Justice Pfeiffer, it seems defense says that this case is really about whether we do or do not affirm the death penalty in this case. And I believe the two sides are coming close to understanding why we're here today.
You
believe that this case is about, can the state of Ohio execute someone for the act of another?
That is correct. I believe that's the crux of, okay. When you look at the case, it was a well-tried case. It was a conservatively tried case. The judge did a great job of managing everything. It was a very well-tried case. I believe the issue is exactly what's been pointed out.
Did you just say it was a well-tried case?
Yes.
And you were trial counsel?
Yeah,
okay.
By everybody involved, yes. Well,
I just want to be clear on that.
I lived through the first one, so I can see. I've watched the growth of this case. And
you know the difference between a well-tried and not well-tried case, given this what one, happened in the first case?
This one definitely felt different. This one definitely felt, the best way to put it is smoother and calmer and more conservative. It certainly did. And we, you know, again, we dialed some things back in the second case with respect to race as a motive. You know, as I stand here before you today, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that race was a motive. Every one of these victims was black. He was only shooting at victims who were black. But we didn't put that in front of the jury. We decided to kind of dial that back and take a little more conservative approach because, frankly, I didn't want to be standing here arguing that. So we really took a much more conservative approach with this case. Now, that being said, the issue still is always what the issue's been in this case is this court willing to affirm a death penalty when the shot that killed the victim wasn't fired by the defendant? Again, the law allows you to do it. The law of the Supreme Court of the United States, the seminal case is the Tyson versus Arizona case. In that case, the holding basically is that states may seek the death penalty against a non-triggerman co-defendant upon a finding that the person attempted to kill, contemplated to kill, anticipated whether a killing would take place, or was a major participant in the crime. And that's the rule from the United States Supreme Court in these non-triggerman situations. And I don't know how familiar the court is with the facts of Tyson, but clearly in that case, the defendant wasn't the triggerman. As a matter of fact, he was getting water. They had broken his dad, the defendant's dad, out of prison. And as part of the jailbreak, the dad and another inmate, the wheel blows on their getaway car. So they end up kidnapping a family of four to take their car, take them out in the desert and try to figure out what to do with them. The defendant and some of his brothers who were part of the jailbreak, they're loading supplies from car to car that they're going to take. And actually the defendant is getting the family of four water because he thinks they're just going to leave them out in the desert. And all of a sudden the dad and the other inmate that they escaped gun down the family of four. So they hop in the car, they take off, and a couple days later there's a shootout, and they're caught, the dad's killed, you know, several people are killed. But Tyson is tried for the death penalty in Arizona, even though he wasn't the shooter, even though he wasn't the trigger man, even though he wasn't aware that a killing was going to take place. And that case, he was convicted, he was sentenced to death. That case made it all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States, and that's where the Supreme Court set forth the rule, look, non-triggermen can be you know, subject to the death penalty if they attempted or were basically a major participant in the case.
Should we look at the fact that Dean was a 30-year-old adult and his co-defendant was a 16-year-old juvenile?
Absolutely. And in the case, I think what is so critical is, you know, the Roper versus Simmons is the United States Supreme Court case that says the juveniles cannot get the death penalty. And in the Roper case, the United States Supreme Court does a great job of laying out factors to look at as to why juveniles shouldn't be subject to death penalty. Juveniles lack maturity and have an underdeveloped sense of responsibility that often results in ill-considered actions and decisions. Juveniles are more susceptible to negative influences and peer pressure. A juvenile's character is not as well formed as that of an adult. All of those things are present here in this situation. I mean, if you look at it, there was a letter that was into evidence where Jason Dean writes Rhonda Sions, and he talks about the fact that he's known Josh Wade since Josh was a baby, that he used to change Josh Wade's diapers. And when he got out of prison on April 1st, 2005, he gave Josh his clothes. You know, they were hanging together. He set him up. So certainly all of those factors apply. Again, if you think about it, that's the way it works in society. If you have siblings, a couple different siblings, and they're breaking rules and they get in trouble, who gets punished? The older brother. Why? The older brother should have known better. Younger brother looks up to older brother. You know, younger brother wouldn't have done this, but older brother led him astray. All of those facts are in play here. To a certain extent, not only is Dean responsible for Titus Arnold's death, but he's responsible for leading Josh Wade down a path that results in Josh Wade now spending the rest of his life in prison. And there's a case that this court reviewed, the Ballew, B-A-L-L-E-W case, where one of the things that troubled this court, one of the things the court actually pointed out, was that Ballew, he basically had recruited a bunch of friends to go settle a drug debt, and they take the guy who owed drug money, they take him out into these woods. Ballew and another guy named Coffee walk him into the woods, and someone ends up killing him. It's never quite clear who did it. But one of the things that the court points out is that Blue is responsible for recruiting friends who actually ended up going to prison because of their the fact that he enticed them to come. Another case that is pointed out in the briefs is the Getzey case. And in the Getzey case, again, this court, one of the things that troubled this court is that Getzey, although he wasn't the trigger man, he was the person who set this all up. He's the one who arranged it. He was the mastermind behind it. And the court expressed, when looking at proportionality, some concern that the mastermind wasn't subject to the death penalty. So all of those things certainly apply here. I'd ask you again, a bright line ruling that says that a defendant whose co-defendant is a juvenile and is ineligible for the death penalty and commits a murder, that a bright line ruling says that defendant can't get the death penalty, certainly would encourage adults to recruit kids to do their killing. And as you look at the classic case, as I was preparing, I'm like, what cases are out there that highlight this? The D.C. sniper case is the classic case that you take a look at. And again, in that case, the adult groomed the child, trained the child, supplied the gun, supplied the car, supplied the motive, and had the child do his killing for him. It's easy to say, well, look, that's not really a good comparison. They killed 10 people in a three-week period. But if you look at what Josh Wade and Jason Dean did, they were on pace. You know, Jason Dean gets out of prison April 1st, 2005. April 10th, they have their first shooting, and April 13th, Titus Arnold's dead. In a period of roughly 3 to 4 days, they had attempted to murder 6 people and actually murdered 1 person. The evidence shows that after they murdered Titus Arnold, because that gun misfired, they traded it out and they had a new 380. They got a new gun. And again, that shows that course of conduct, that this spree was going to continue. I'm going to finish with this. At the end of this trial, actually at the sentencing, the judge asked Jason Dean, do you have anything to say? And Jason Dean stood up and he said, Judge, I'd like to thank you. You know, I thought you were very fair. I'd like to thank my defense attorneys. They did a great job. I felt like they fought really hard for me. He didn't go as far as thanking the state, but you know what he didn't do? He didn't stand up and yell, you guys railroaded me. You ran over my rights. This isn't just. I just don't think, whether or not you agree with the death penalty or don't agree with the death penalty, that we have it here in Ohio, and I just don't think you can get a better statement of a fair trial and the way the system should work as those comments from the defendant in this case.
Counsel, I hear your argument, and I agree with most of it. But at the end of the day, I guess you agreed with Justice O'Donnell that it was a proper statement of the law on transferred intent. So that if you're looking for a bright line test, is there going to be a temporal tie between the intent to kill one person and the killing of another?
No,
If
I decide that I want to kill somebody and I brood on it for a month and I make the necessary preparations for a month and then a month later I end up looking for that person and killing somebody else, the transferred intent would still apply.
No, I guess my question though is if there's, say, 4 to 6 people on a porch and I attempt to murder person number 3, but due to my lack of skill, or maybe shooting through a car, as you answered to the chief, let's leave that alone for now, and I shoot not person number 3, but person number 2, that's transferred intent, correct?
Yes.
But that didn't happen in this case, did it?
I mean, you had individual intent for each of those people up on the... You don't even need to get to transferred intent at that point because you have individual intent for each of those people up there. Even if you go under the theory that he's just looking for OZ, well, that's only one person. When he starts shooting at the other people up on that porch, he has an individual specific intent with respect to each of those folks. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel, you've saved a little over 2 minutes.
Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of things I wanted to bring out. First of all, I appreciate that Mr. Wilson was involved in both the trials Mr. Dean ended up going through in this case, but he really should have confined himself to the record. There was a lot of the evidence that he mentions during, and he's just telling you about off the cuff, his cuff, that he remembers that it's not evidence in this case or was not evidence that was before the jury. And so the court needs to confine itself to the record of this case.
Well, help us out with that. It's a big record. What specifically did Prosecutor Wilson say that?
Well, first of all, the evidence concerning the fact that he had just gotten out of prison did not go before the jury. That's not something that was considered in this case at all.
Okay.
He talked a lot about OZ being a person who, is infamous in the Springfield area. The emphasis on OZ was not great in this case, and there was no evidence to indicate that OZ was up on the porch anywhere so that he thought he was shooting at OZ. That they were going to the Dibert Avenue address looking for Devon Williams.
Was there evidence that OZ was really the person that they were interested in or not?
OZ was mentioned, but there was not a lot of evidence that came before the jury concerning OZ and what exactly the beef was, between Jason or between.
So you're saying the trial was mostly about the mayhem that your client and his buddy were creating all over town, without particular focus on one individual.
There were the three incidences, and as it relates to the Dibert Avenue, I would also point out that this case occurred in April. It also occurred late at night, and there was no even indication that they could actually see the people up on the porch when they were shooting at the porch. Just in conclusion, I would briefly say that Jason...
Wait a minute. What do you think was going on there then?
I think that what they were doing was what they did with the car. I think they... Their goal was to look at the car and to look at the house. And they shot the car.
They wanted specifically to find Mr. Williams. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. They knew Mr. Williams loved his car, and a way to get to Mr. Williams was to shoot the car. And so, and you know, then they were going to probably, you know, if indeed that would follow, they would shoot at the house. But there was no indication that they were going to kill anyone, Devon Williams or anybody else. They just shot at the house.
You're saying that there was no way that they would have known that people were present.
There was no, yeah. I mean, how would they know that the people would be at the house? And it was dark.
Apparently,
so then,
the testimony is when the car was being shot up, people came out of the house.
The people testified they came out of the house. There was no evidence that he saw the people coming out of the house, or that they were trying to shoot the people that were then on the porch.
Didn't one of them have a bullet hole that went through their jacket?
They did, but again, it wasn't, you know, they're, you know, if they're just shooting or spraying bullets at the porch, I mean, there is going to be, you know.
Well, what about Titus Arnold? Was it that they just saw some guy with a backpack going down the street and they decided to rob him?
They had been in a bar. They had, according to the testimony of the state, they had looked around. Their MO supposedly was to lure people out of a bar and rob them. They had been in this bar just moments before. There didn't appear to be anybody, I guess, that looked like they had any money, so they came out of the bar and then they saw Mr. Arnold. Whether they, you know, the backpack, or they thought he was this other person or whatever inspired them to go.
So that was just a robbery. It wasn't connected to anything else.
Not that the evidence would indicate.
Well, it was connected to their modus operandi of finding somebody to rob so that they could, they were on a criminal path here.
Right, but their criminal path generally wasn't including killing people. It was finding somebody to rob and robbing them.
Except for the mini-mart shooting.
And that did kind of, you know, but I mean, there was nothing, I mean, who were they robbing at the Dybert Avenue address? There was nobody they were robbing. They were just, you know, shooting the car, shooting the house.
Well, that's not just. I mean, it's pretty serious
behavior.
When
you're going to take my client's life for it, it should be something more than shooting at a car. I mean, a car is not a person, and so if you're going to execute somebody, there
so
really
you're
needs
saying
to be
if you let's just if you eliminate the porch being sprayed with bullets, you know, and that take that out of the equation. And you have then your client shooting the folks at the mini mart.
I would concede Andre Pearsall.
That he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then the other person was shot at, and they drove to the hospital.
I don't believe that she was ever shot at, because the bullets and the testimony was that the bullet went, you know, if she's sitting in the driver's seat, and Jason Dean is here, the shots are going here into the passenger seat. He's not aiming at her, he's aiming at Andre Pearsall.
Okay. You're giving your clients a lot more marksmanship credit than I would. So then you've got the cold-blooded murder of Mr. Arnold. And is that, how would we, those two incidences, how should we look at those two instances?
Again, I think that you have to look at it, first of all, that again, Mr. Dean was not the principal offender in the case.
But you know that the law allows for the principal offender to be convicted of the death penalty.
I am aware of that, Your Honor.
And you're just saying that that's just not fair here.
I'm saying that there's enough evidence, particularly relating to all of the offenses, but if you just want to focus on those two, that's not enough to get the death penalty in this case, that we shouldn't execute Jason Dean just because we couldn't execute Joshua Wade.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.